polar bears have been listed as endangered for 7 years, and the recently released conservation management plan mandated by the Endangered Species Act doesn't paint a very happy outcome for them, especially Alaska's population of the bears. I'm Lori Townsend. If greenhouse gas emissions are slowed down, Alaska's polar bear population will still have a tough go over the next couple of decades. But if emissions are not reined in, the outlook for their survival in Alaska is much more bleak. How to help the Arctic's top predator survive is our topic today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. There's no question that the Arctic is warming, and it's happening faster in the Arctic than in any other place in the world. This has enormous implications for pretty much everything. And today, we're going to focus on one of the best-known representatives of the far north, polar bears. In as little as a decade, Alaska's population could be nearly gone. Does this matter? If it does, what can be done to address it? Here to discuss a new plan by Fish and Wildlife to help polar bears survive are Eric Regeer. Eric is with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. He's a polar bear team wildlife biologist. I think I might have turned that around a little bit, Eric, but good morning.
Good morning, Lori.
Thanks for being here. Also, Jennifer Kohout is with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. She is the regional program manager and co-chair of the Polar Bear Recovery Team. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Margaret Williams is the director of the World Wildlife Fund's Arctic Program. Good morning, Margaret.
Hey, Lori.
And also, Todd Atwood is a research wildlife biologist and lead of U.S. Geological Survey's Polar Bear Research Program. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
So we have a great team in the studio with us today. In 2008, polar bears were listed as endangered. That listing cited rapidly depleting sea ice due to global warming as the primary threat to their survival. Human activity is exacerbating atmospheric warming. So since that listing 7 years ago, has there been progress on addressing this identified threat, or has it been business as usual? Who wants to jump in on that one?
Yeah, that's silence. This is Jennifer. Lori, I'll go ahead and jump in. I'll dive in just speaking to the plan. I mean, there has been a lot of attention to the issue, and certainly for polar bears, we recognize that climate change is the largest threat to the species, and Todd can speak more in detail about his research to kind of update those results. From a planning perspective, in terms of polar bear conservation, what we've done here is pull together a very diverse team of representatives from a lot of different interests to talk about what we can do to help conserve polar bears, recognizing that climate change is, in fact, the biggest issue. Certainly some of the participants in the process have taken steps to move towards dealing with their own carbon emissions, but I think clearly we recognize it's an issue that requires commitment globally to address the problem. So one of the big factors we're seeking to undertake in this plan is to make that point, you know, to make it known that, yes, that is the biggest threat, and we need to be clear in our communications about that and our science.
Mm-hmm. If you'd like to join our conversation today, please do. You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. In the Anchorage area, the number locally is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. The Endangered Species Act requires the Recovery Conservation Plan for Endangered Species. Tell us a little bit about that process. How do you bring this big document together, and what does the plan lay out specifically for polar bears?
Sure. This is Jennifer. Again, I'll start with that. You're correct. Once a species is listed as threatened or endangered, we're required under the Endangered Species Act to complete a recovery plan. And there's a parallel process under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which also applies to polar bear, to create a conservation plan. In this case, we decided to undertake both those planning processes at once. As an aside, the plan is also going to be appended to an international plan that the five countries that have polar bears are creating in parallel with this process. So our national plan will be appended to that. So we started by kind of a big undertaking in terms of addressing all those different perspectives. But with the ESA recovery plan, the idea is that you're creating criteria that you are looking to meet as you go forward in trying to conserve polar bears and ultimately remove them from the endangered species list. And you're also looking to identify specific actions that we and others can undertake to move polar bears towards meeting those criteria.
Are there distinctions between a conservation plan and a recovery plan?
Well, one of the big distinctions is under the Endangered Species Act, the recovery plan, we're looking to address the reasons why the species was listed. Basically, you want to get to a point where the protections of the Endangered Species Act are no longer required, so you're comfortable that the species is not at threat of becoming endangered. The standard is different under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. You're looking to manage a population towards what's called an optimal sustainable population. So the standard's different, and our criteria in the plan, we address those in very distinct ways in terms of what needs to happen to meet those two.
The polar bears were listed as endangered 7 years ago. Why does it take so many years to build a conservation recovery plan for a species?
Yeah, just one quick correction. Actually, listed as threatened at this point, so there's a distinction between threatened versus
endangered.
No problem.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I mean, it's a process. For us, it was sort of an evolving one. We started in 2010 with a series of open stakeholder meetings with the intent that the service would then write the plan, draft the plan, and seek public comment. And we pretty quickly discovered that really we need to engage the parties that are on the ground living and already working with polar bears in the creation of this plan. So we switched gears and we created this recovery team in 2013. Engaged 37 individuals associated with 15 different agencies and organizations, and took the time to work through the process with them. And it's a very diverse group. I mean, I'm talking about folks from the Alaska Native community, including the North Slope Borough and the Alaska Nanook Commission, representatives from the state of Alaska, representatives from environmental groups like Defenders of Wildlife and World Wildlife Fund. And also industry. We had a representative from ConocoPhillips and from Alaska Oil and Gas Association, along with a lot of federal representation. So it took time to kind of get all the interests out on the table and work through those and kind of come together with a plan that we felt represented the basic principles we all were comfortable with.
What are those meetings like? Is it contentious? You have people with very competing interests coming together. How difficult is it to sort of have some decorum in these discussions so that you can get to a place where everybody sort of agrees? Eric, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, thank you, Lori. certainly, some of the issues involved in polar bear conservation are contentious, but one thing I've found, and I think was certainly exemplified by the recovery team, was that when you get everybody in a room together talking, the differences aren't nearly as large as they seemed when everybody was in their respective locations or offices. The real focus of the plan has been to identify common goals. And across this broad group of stakeholders, everyone from federal entities, state government, Native governments, Alaska Nanook Commission, industry, et cetera, we really do share a lot of common values with regard to the conservation management of polar bears. And so I think that's one of the real strengths of this plan, is bringing together this very diverse group of people and identifying common ground and trying to do what we can for the species that's respectful of everybody's perspectives. So it was a very impressive process in that regard.
We're talking about polar bears today. If you're just tuning in, this is Talk of Alaska, and we have a variety of experts in the studio. If you live in a community near polar bears and would like to comment. What do you think should be done to help polar bears survive and thrive into the future? Is it important to you that polar bears continue to live, especially in Alaska? You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's statewide, 1-800-478-8255, or in the Anchorage area, 550-8422, 550-8422. And you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. How successful are recovery conservation plans generally? Can you point to some species that have recovered and thrived after such a plan was put in place?
I am aware of some, but Todd,
specific
please. Examples.
I think there are a couple of excellent large carnivore examples. Gray wolf recovery in the Rocky Mountain region. In a period of about 15 years, gray wolves were recovered and removed from the endangered species list, then put back on and then removed again, but that was a litigation process. We're seeing the same thing occur with grizzly bears in the lower 48, the greater Yellowstone ecoregion. That's taken a little bit longer, several decades, but it's been largely a success. And the successes, I think, of those two programs have for a large part, been founded in cooperative interactions between state and federal agencies, NGO partners, tribal agencies, broad-based coalitions where people share some differences, some minor differences, but a larger common goal, which is removing the species from the endangered species list. I think we're on the same track here with polar bears. We've assembled a broad-based coalition. There are some differences, but as Eric mentioned, in sitting through these meetings, which we've sat through a lot, they've been remarkably amicable from my standpoint. And I think that highlights the core value that these different groups have, which is trying to ensure the long-term persistence of polar bears, whether it be for cultural reasons, for intrinsic value, for regulatory purposes. There are a number of reasons why I think we're all rallying around this cause of conserving polar bears for as long as we can.
Well, I want to come back to the scope of this situation with the polar bears as compared to some of those other species that you mentioned, because we're facing a pretty formidable foe in climate change and the impacts to bears. But Margaret, we haven't heard from you yet, so I'd like to get your perspective on sitting at that table and being in those discussions. How was that process?
Well, actually, one of my colleagues has been the representative for World Wildlife on the meeting on this recovery plan. But generally, World Wildlife Fund has, I think we agree very much with Eric and Todd, that this is a goal. Recovery of polar bears, or at least stabilization of polar bears, is a common goal. And I think there are, the group represents a very diverse slice of interest in Alaska that want to work together to ensure that we do have polar bears as part of our future. And one of the things that we were particularly pleased about was the recognition of the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as really the number one step in this plan. And when the species was first listed, it was unclear as to whether Fish and Wildlife Service could call for other government agencies to take part in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, because it's really other agencies such as the EPA and even the other branches of the Department of Interior, which will be responsible for bringing down greenhouse gas emissions. By Interior, I mean, for example, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which issues lease sales, which indirectly or actually directly will contribute to increasing greenhouse gases by allowing for leasing of oil areas. But sorry, I'm getting off on a tangent. But basically, we were very pleased that this was a high priority to call for other agencies to reduce greenhouse gases. There were some things that we think could be stronger in the plan. I can get to those later. But very much lots in common.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. The plan does list the main identified stressor that's affecting the bear's ability to thrive. The top of the list is the loss of sea ice. And so does this plan carry any weight for addressing the cause? We just had a U.S. Supreme Court decision that knocked back the EPA's ability to regulate coal-fired gas emissions. How does this plan put pressure on other agencies within the federal government to really address these things that are affecting polar bears? Can it? Does it? Jennifer?
Thanks, Laura. So the plan is not a regulatory document. It really is just a planning document. It's an aspirational document. It's us identifying the most important things for polar bear conservation. And I think, you know, we worked very hard to make that very clear and make that point up front. I think our vision, you know, recognizing that the Fish and Wildlife Service nor the stakeholders that were involved in the plan have the legal authority to make the regulatory changes we're talking about, we feel very strongly that we do have a role in telling an important story about how climate change is affecting not only polar bear, but Alaska Native cultures that are living on the coast and experiencing it firsthand. And that's the message we wanted to come clear in the document.
And Eric, did you want to add something? I know a couple of minutes ago you were wanting to jump in there.
Oh, thanks, Lori. Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on your question and Todd's great response about the history of the Endangered Species Act and examples of its successes, and make the point that while I think that the successful stories of wolves and grizzly bears are certainly applicable to polar bears, there's also a novelty in the challenge we're facing here. Is in a lot of previous examples of the ESA, there were more specific and tangible threats that could be addressed directly through sometimes localized regulatory action. One of the big challenges for polar bears and for several other species of Arctic marine mammal is the pervasiveness of this threat. So this is loss of their sea ice habitat associated with global climate change. And as Jennifer spoke to, this is not a threat that will be overcome through local or even regional or national actions, but will take concerted global action. And so that is a way in which there are a lot of things that we can do in the here and now to improve polar bear conservation. These depend on working with partners and local actions. The plan speaks to those things. But it also identifies the larger pervasive threat of sea ice loss and really calls attention to, despite the fact that we in this plan do not have the regulatory authority to address it directly, that is the key thing in the long term that needs to be addressed to conserve this species.
Right. Margaret.
Yeah, I would just say that this plan comes at a very important time for the world and for the United States, because in December there will be the UN Conference of the Parties on an agreement regarding climate change. And so it's really important for people, Alaskans and other Americans, to realize once again we have this glaring example of how climate change is impacting the world around us, the Arctic sea ice, the species that depend on it. And so it's another call to action for global leadership on climate change.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we're talking about the conservation management plan for polar bears. They're in trouble, and sea ice loss is the main problem. We'll also discuss some of the other things that can be done to help conserve polar bears. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-478-8255 statewide, or in Anchorage, 550-8422. We're going to go to the phones for just a moment here. Leslie is in Anchorage. Good morning.
Good morning, Lori. The question I have for the team there, and I'm not sure who might tackle it, but it's been on my mind for a while, and it's kind of we need to do things in two ways. One of them is to reduce what's going on with climate change, but the second thing is to mitigate for what's already happening for polar bears because of that lack of sea ice. Is there any discussion about creating platforms that can be utilized, and I'm not even sure that polar bears would use them, but platforms that could be placed throughout the Chukchi and other environs where they hunt and also be used for pinnipeds to haul out on? And just curious about that, if that's part of the discussion in terms of mitigation. And I'll I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
Well, thank you, Leslie. That's a really interesting and unusual thought that I'd never heard before. Margaret, would you like to tackle that?
Sure. This is Margaret from World Wildlife Fund. We, every once in a while, we get a call in our office suggesting from different engineers or people who would like to help rebuild some kind of a habitat like that. The thing is, the Arctic sea ice is its own incredible ecosystem. It's incredibly vast. And it is incredibly rich. And I like to think of it as a little greenhouse, which supports all kinds of plankton and microorganisms, which are part of the rich food chain in the Arctic. So it would really be a very difficult to recreate that.
Mm-hmm. And Todd?
Yeah, that's an interesting proposal. And it's something that we've heard before. I think it's kind of constrained, though, by just some basic logistical concerns, but also some ecological concerns. You know, the sea ice ecosystem is highly dynamic, and aside from kind of the complex food web interactions that happen underneath the sea ice is moving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, polar bears rely on sea ice primarily as a platform to access prey. And they move as that sea ice moves, as their prey moves.
Right.
So we've got a lot of complicated moving parts here that would make it really difficult to have stationary large swaths of some type of artificial ice the polar bears would actually benefit from.
Absolutely. It's an interesting idea, but I can see why it would be difficult to carry out something like that, especially in an area as vast as the Arctic is. It would be pretty difficult to figure out something like that. We're going to go to the phones again. Greg is in Homer. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, and thank you, panel, and thank you for airing this. And just want to let you know that I do love polar bears, but I never want to hug one because I'll probably end up as their dinner, unlike a tree hugger. My concern is we're going under a presidential campaign right now, and what I'm hearing from one party and foremost is that I am not a scientist, and I don't know if climate change is man-made or not. And my simple question is, and I'll take it off the air, is how do we get the politicians to listen to scientists? Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. That could be the $64,000 question. Margaret, I bet you'd like to tackle that one.
This is Margaret from World Wildlife Fund. And Greg, we need you to remind our leaders that we do have excellent scientists. And really, there is no debate. There's a few vocal people in the vocal minority who like to make it into a political thing. But it's not. We can look around Alaska. We have had 200 wildfires burning in Alaska this summer. We have had record warm temperatures in May, in June, record minimal sea ice coverage in the last, most of the last decade. We have signs of changing chemistry in the Arctic Ocean. These are huge, huge, glaring. It's not about fuzzy models or fuzzy math. These are huge, very clear signs of change that is occurring right before our eyes. So what we need now to do is think about solutions. It's no more about whether it's true or not. This is happening. Our planet is changing. And what we need to do is ensure that we don't exacerbate the warming anymore, and we have so many incredible solutions and doable and affordable ways of reducing our carbon footprint. And so that's what we need to focus on.
Eric, you had something you wanted to add here.
Yeah, and that's indeed the $64,000 question from Greg. But I think one thing it leads to is that I think our discourse on environmental issues and on polar bears, the clarity of it can be improved if we actually try to do a good job of separating the science from the policy. Mm-hmm. When it comes to climate change, the overwhelming body of evidence is indeed that there is a warming trend caused by human activity. That's the science. The policy question is, what do we do about it? And to the extent that we can separate those, I think the dialogue becomes more productive. No one really asks, do you believe that your microwave works? Science made it work, and it works. And the question is, what do you do with your microwave? I mean, similarly, to the extent that we can separate these things, separate the facts and the evidence, be critical, ask difficult questions, but look at the overwhelming body of evidence, and then from then go to what should we as a society do about it? I think that can only be helpful for these issues.
Separate the heat from the light.
Yeah.
So we have an email question here that's kind of looking for some of the basics that I should have asked earlier. How many polar bears are there on Earth? And so where are these different? There's 4 ecoregions, I think 19 populations. Can give us some of the mechanics of these numbers and where they're at.
Yeah, this is Eric. That's a great question. So polar bears are distributed throughout the circumpolar Arctic. Pretty much wherever you can find sea ice, you can find a polar bear. And the world's polar bear population is divided into about 19 different subpopulations. So throughout the Arctic, there are about 25,000 of these animals divided into 19 subpopulations for management purposes. It's a very interesting point regarding both the ESA listing and the conservation of these animals is that the current abundance of polar bears, approximately 25,000, is not greatly reduced from the abundance 20, 30, 40 years ago. The species as a whole in many parts of its range was actually depleted in the 50s and 60s due to overharvest. Now, with the passage of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and protections on the harvest of polar bears, for example, here in Alaska, harvest is limited to subsistence harvest by Native Alaskans, which is done in a responsible, conservation-oriented manner. With such measures across the Arctic, global numbers actually did rebound to the point where we have about 25,000 today. That said, currently some of these subpopulations, including one of the 2 located here in the United States, the Southern Beaufort Sea subpopulation located north of Alaska, is exhibiting declines because of loss of their sea ice habitat. So, you know, the past 30 years, an increasing trend due to better harvest management, and currently in some areas, decreasing trends due to sea ice loss. Well, at the same time, in some areas, some subpopulations of polar bears, for example, in the Chukchi Sea west of Alaska, currently appear to be productive despite the sea ice loss. So it's actually kind of a mixed bag throughout the Arctic, although all bears throughout the Arctic face the pervasive and long-term threat of loss of their habitat.
When they were depleted, what did the numbers drop down to? 25,000 doesn't seem like a very huge number for a worldwide population to begin with. And so when they were depleted, does anyone have an idea of Todd?
Well, this is Todd. Yeah, I think we don't have an idea, and that's part of the problem. You know, there wasn't really much attention paid to sport hunting, commercial harvest, prior to the international agreement, which was 1973. We do have anecdotal reports of what sure appears to be a fair amount of over-harvest occurring in the 60s. As Eric was saying, the estimate of 20 to 25,000 bears is the best we have, but it's also a pretty soft estimate. There are a number of subpopulations where we've never had an abundance estimate. There are a handful of subpopulations where we get occasional abundance estimates, and then there are an even fewer handful of subpopulations where we get regular abundance estimates. Part of the challenge of kind of bringing this all together under the umbrella of a conservation management plan is the lack of data from some parts of the world. And it's not to kind of call other entities out for not being able to assemble those data. It's just that it's very logistically difficult and expensive in some parts of the world to collect data on polar bears. And I think that circles back to perhaps one of the key challenges and differences between this conservation management plan and other recovery plans is that, you know, we're recovering, or we're talking about polar bears and recovering them from a future state. They're currently not in a state that we would call severely depleted, although, as Eric mentioned, there are a handful of populations that have been declining and have a declining trend over a longer term. We're looking, you know, at the mid-century mark and saying, based on what greenhouse gas trajectories are likely to be, based on the relationship between greenhouse gases, global temperatures, sea ice characteristics, it's highly likely that polar bears will be at risk in the mid-century mark. And so we're trying to think far into the future and try and recover them from a future state, which is really challenging, and I think it really kind of a novel approach.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And we are going to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll go back to the phones and talk with our guests about the conservation of polar bears into the future as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing polar bears and their survival into the future. We have a number of guests and experts in our studio today. You can also join our conversation. Statewide, the number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. The local number is 550-8422, 550-8422. We also can take your question by email, talk@alaskapublic.org. I do have an email question I want to get to in a moment and a couple callers on the line. But one of the questions I wanted to ask about, the system is so dynamic and there's so many variables. The modeling is getting better and better, but I know for myself, when I first came to Alaska 15 years ago and started reporting here, there was conversation about ice-free Arctics or ice-free summers in the Arctic in, you know, maybe 100 years. Then it got dropped down to about 50 years, and now it's kind of here. How difficult is it, given that how quickly things have changed and how the realization of what is happening with this dynamic system and the variables, how difficult was it to come up with a plan that you really felt confident reflected what's really going on in this system?
I'll start that, maybe hand it off to Todd or Eric to supplement. But one of the things we did in the plan was try to be very transparent about the criteria in terms of articulating when we thought a species would be recovered. So we laid out a fundamental goal of we want a fairly high level of probability that the species would persist, but that's not really something you could measure. So then we stepped that down to a demographic level, and through some of Eric's work identified the most key aspects of a population that would indicate to us that the population was actually stable, and stable over a long period of time. So we were looking at a 100-year period. And then we stepped that down to a level of threats criteria. So not only would you have a population that you felt was stable based on some key factors, but you also knew that sea ice was no longer retreating, you know, as you look forward modeling. So I think what we've done, you know, as Todd mentioned, in a kind of a novel situation is we've identified criteria that we think are going to adapt to the latest science, understanding that as we go forward, we'll have to continue to monitor very closely to see where we are in terms of meeting those criteria and also to further refine the criteria as we learn more.
Okay, so the plan is not set in stone. It can be changed and it's malleable. That's probably good. Margaret, did you have something that you wanted to add? Or?
Oh, well, I was just thinking of it. Absolutely correct in highlighting the dynamic nature of the natural ecosystem. And the other dynamic nature of the Arctic is the human nature. And things are changing also in terms of human development, economic development. And that's something that I just wanted to highlight in the plan that we'd like to see more of. And this hopefully will be the next iteration, is the issue of oil and gas development in polar bear habitat. And one of the callers, I think that was Leslie earlier, asked about opportunities for mitigating current threats to polar bears. And one of those things that we can do and that humans can control is the extent to which we allow for offshore extractive activities in polar bear habitat. And as Eric mentioned, we have two polar bears in the United States, the Chukchi Sea population, which we share with Russia, and the Beaufort Sea population, which we share with Canada. And in both of those places, there are extensive plans for offshore oil and gas development. And currently, as we speak, Shell Oil is on its way to the Arctic. It's hoping to get final permissions to go ahead and do exploratory drilling. And the Department of Interior, in its own environmental assessment, has stated that there is a possibility of a large oil spill in the life of this oil development if it goes forward. So World Wildlife Fund is very concerned about this. We know it's impossible to clean up an oil spill in the Arctic environment. The place where the Shell is planning to do exploratory drilling is 70 miles offshore from the nearest coastal community. And so it's a very, very risky prospect. And we only have one Arctic, and it's an incredibly productive place. And we need to think about resilience of the ecosystem, resilience of the polar bears, resilience of the walrus. And adding this additional threat, which we have no way to contain, is really is quite contradictory to thinking about resilience.
Todd.
Well, yeah, Margaret brings up a good point about, you know, there are a number of threats out there, and you know, we somewhat, I think, feel like we're playing catch up. The ecosystem is changing very quickly, and it's hard to keep pace with the changes that we're seeing. One of the things that we did in this plan was put in a threats assessment section where we look at all of the known and hypothesized threats to future populations. And that was actually an analysis that we did. We basically projected the influence of known and hypothesized threats on population outcomes at four future time periods: early century, mid-century, late century, and end of the century. And we did this to look at the relative importance or the relative influence of individual threats. What we found was that by an overwhelming majority, the dominant threat to the long-term persistence of polar bears is loss of sea ice habitat. Second to that is access to marine prey, which is primarily ice seals. And those two kind of go hand in hand. Without the sea ice, bears can't access their prey. But these other threats, these threats that are related to human activities, are also influential, just not to the extent that sea ice loss and access to prey is. It doesn't mean you shouldn't manage for them, but it means that if you want to ensure the long-term persistence of polar bears, you really have to address the primary threat, which is greenhouse gas emissions.
All right. I want to stay on that point and also get to the Alaska Native component and element in all of this, because, of course, that's very important as well. But let's take another caller here. We've got some calls stacking up. Amy is in Anchorage. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
Do you have a comment or a question?
My quick question, yes. My question is, if you lose a keystone predator like a polar bear in the Arctic ecosystem, what are the far-reaching consequences of that?
Well, thanks for that question.
Yeah, this is Todd. That's a good question. You know, I think that there are certainly cultural effects of that. There's a strong relationship between Native communities and polar bears that extends beyond subsistence. There's also probably a keystone ecological relationship in that they're an apical predator. We've seen in other ecosystems, when you take the top predator out of an ecosystem, things kind of reassort, and we see changes in community structure. I guess the short answer is we really don't know what the effects of removing a top predator from the Arctic marine ecosystem might be.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Alaska Native aspect of subsistence harvest, and not just Native peoples in Alaska, but in other Arctic nations too. Eric, you've worked with a lot of these coastal communities and communities that harvest polar bears. Tell us about how their voices were integrated into this, their concerns, and what are they saying in their communities about this idea?
Yeah, thank you, Lori. Well, I certainly won't attempt to speak for the Alaska Native communities, but I can speak to the importance of cooperative management and working cooperatively with Native communities, Native governments, hunters in rural Alaska, and to how those perspectives were integrated into this recovery plan for polar bears. As Jennifer said, under this plan, the ultimate goal is the continued persistence of polar bears in the wild, recognizing that loss of their sea ice habitat is the primary threat. Another key goal in the plan is to maintain opportunities for subsistence harvest of polar bears by Native Alaskans here in Alaska and by other people throughout the Arctic. And when I refer to subsistence harvest, what that means is the use of these animals for traditional and cultural and nutritional purposes in a conservation-oriented manner that's occurred here in Alaska and throughout the Arctic for thousands of years. So when we put these two goals together, one of the questions that the recovery team dealt with directly is, in light of sea ice loss, is it possible and how is it possible to continue the subsistence harvest in a way that is not negatively, detrimental for polar bear populations? And so we addressed this question as a group. We had some scientific analyses to address the questions. A lot of traditional ecological knowledge was brought to bear. And the short answer is yes, it is indeed possible if we work together and follow sound principles of wildlife management to continue a sustainable subsistence harvest in a manner that doesn't negatively affect polar bear populations despite the loss of their sea ice habitat. To be clear, the plan does not call for any new quotas on polar bear harvest. It doesn't call for new restrictions to polar bear harvest, but rather what it does is outlines an improved framework for the management of subsistence harvest. Key components of this framework we've referred to earlier is continued collection of up-to-date scientific information. We have to understand how populations are faring. There's currently variability in how the populations are faring, and again, that's exemplified by the difference in the status between the two U.S. subpopulations, Southern Beaufort Sea. Appears to be experiencing negative effects of sea ice loss. Chukchi Sea, just to the west, appears productive despite sea ice loss. Under this framework, we have to recognize that if populations do decline in size, the actual number of bears taken each year in a sustainable manner will decline too. It has to be maintained as a sustainable rate or percentage of population size. And then third and critically is working together with Native Alaskans to manage polar bears in a way that's both responsible and respectful of the traditional practices and the importance of these animals as a subsistence resource. I mean, at the end of the day, if you want to manage and conserve a species, you have to work with the people that have intimate history and knowledge of the species that live in polar bear countries, and you have to do it in a collaborative manner. And that's a real focus of the plan and our work with the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Margaret, I know you've worked with the Polar Bear Patrol, and tell us a little bit about what that is, and especially as it relates to, I know that there's not considered a problem in Alaska when it comes to a lack of responsible harvesting, but there has been concern in Russia about those things, about poaching. How has the Polar Bear Patrol worked in Arctic countries, and has it addressed this poaching issue?
Thanks, Lori. I just to reflect on Eric's comments, as a nonprofit organization, World Wildlife Fund appreciates very much the significance in the plan's highlighting of the subsistence values, and it's one of the fundamental goals is recognition and the goal of maintaining the subsistence harvest. So that's something that we really value, and as a conservation organization, World Wildlife Fund recognizes the rights of indigenous people to harvest resources. So as part of that, World Wildlife Fund has been working with communities, particularly in Russia, but now more and more in Alaska with the North Slope Borough, with another northern community. We're just very excited about a new partnership with the Village of Wales and the Fish and Wildlife Service to develop a new polar bear patrol program. But basically, the idea in Russia came from a tiny village where local concerns were growing about the potential for human-wildlife conflict. And a neighboring, this little village is called Vankarem. In a village near Vankarem, a 16-year-old girl was killed by a polar bear in 2006. And the locals in Vankarem, the hunters, said, we really don't want this to happen to any of our kids. And we also know that polar bears are being impacted by climate change. So we want a way to protect polar bears and humans. And they came up with some very simple methods for keeping polar bears away from the village, including taking dead walrus carcasses from the results of a haul out where walruses, oops, had piled up. Sorry. And were an attractant to polar bears, so the villages moved these walrus carcasses out of town. And also, when polar bears did come into the village, they were ready with very simple methods like rubber bullets and noise-making devices. and then did a lot of education with the communities and had a little just way of communicating with the school children, hey, polar bears are around, we need to be extra careful, and so on. And I'll never forget, we invited these Chukchi hunters to a series of, we went to Point Lay, Wainwright, Point Hope, and Barrow. And our friend Vladilin Kavri, a Chukchi native colleague and friend, came to these villages in Alaska and said, when times were tough for us, polar bears and walrus helped us survive. Hmm. There was a time when they, especially after the Soviet Union fell apart, it was extremely difficult to get any basic food supplies, and they're completely reliant on nature for survival. And so they looked toward polar bears and walrus to help them, you know, literally survive. And they said, now we know that climate change is impacting these animals and we need to help them. So they created these polar bear patrols, and they've been very successful in preventing any human mortality, any attacks in this village. And they've done a tremendous effort to educate people about polar bears.
And what about addressing the issue of poaching? Because that was a big issue in Russia. What's been done to help stop that?
Well, unfortunately, the nature of the current law in Russia, any harvest of any polar bear is considered a poaching because polar bear hunting has been outlawed since 1956. And although the U.S.-Russia polar bear agreement allows for a harvest in Russia, it has not been implemented. And it's really, there's quite a contrast in the way that our federal agencies here, like Fish and Wildlife Service and U.S. Geological Survey, are working with entities in Alaska to make it to ensure and protect the subsistence harvest in Alaska. That is not happening in Russia. It's quite behind in progress.
Yeah, it seems quite rigid. Eric?
Yeah, I'd follow up on Margaret's comments there to say that I do believe we've made significant progress toward cooperative management of the Chukchi Sea population, which is shared with Russia. So there is an international treaty between the U.S. and Russia on the conservation and management of the shared polar bear population. That's led by commissioners, which are federal and native representatives from both countries. And so under that treaty, we have, based on the best available science and traditional ecological knowledge, identified a sustainable limit for subsistence harvest. In coming years, that limit will be implemented cooperatively with our partners in Western Alaska here in the U.S. And the hope is, as Margaret said, that eventually and over time, and these things do take time to change, but in Russia, the currently illegal and to a large extent unquantified take of polar bears will be replaced by a legal, regulated, and well-managed subsistence take of polar bears under this framework. And so it is a long process. The social and economic and other systems in both countries are very different, but it is really an incredible treaty between the two countries that brings together federal, native, and other stakeholders in polar bear conservation to improve the conservation of this population, one key aspect being a sustainable manage of human-caused removals, one component of which is subsistence harvest.
All right. Well, thank you. We're going to take one more quick break and we'll continue the conversation about the survival of polar bears into the future as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Alaska Pacific University offers a distinctive, personalized education grounded in hands-on, real-world experience that prepares graduates to be contributing members and leaders in their communities. This message is sponsored by APU.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the survival of polar bears today. We have a number of experts in our studio, and we were just discussing the conservation and how to do a sustainable subsistence harvest for a very important aspect of both food in the diet and cultural needs, artwork, all the things that Native peoples do with polar bears and other species. And one of the things that has been a success story is the cooperative management of bowhead whales. They were a species that was in decline and now is growing, I think, at about 5% per year. Is that correct,
Margaret? I think it's even higher. I think 7%.
Okay. So we have seen that the right type of management can work, and that is a good sign, hopefully, for the future of polar bears. Let's hope it is. All right, let's go back to the phones quickly. Priscilla is in Homer. We have a lot of calls from Homer today. Hi, Priscilla.
Hi. Yeah, I you mentioned this somewhat about shell and exploration in the Arctic and production of oil there, but I feel and that's very counterproductive to the protection of the Arctic and polar, including polar bears and other species. There can be spills. Oil also, use of oil creates greenhouse gases. I think there should be a stronger, well, I don't know if I should use the word protest, but movement against this drilling in the Arctic. That's just my feeling.
All right. Okay, thank you, Priscilla. We have discussed that somewhat, but you know, that kind of leads to a natural question about how much clout does a U.S. plan have? It's not just U.S. emissions that we're talking about. Certainly, it's global emissions. What kind of clout does a plan that the U.S. comes up with for conservation and identifies right at the top, sea ice loss is the big problem, and we know what is exacerbating sea ice loss. So what happens? The U.S. says, here's a conservation management plan, but the implications are global. What happens?
All right. This is Jennifer. So a couple of things. As I mentioned, this plan will be appended to a broader circumpolar action plan that all the range states are pulling together. So certainly our hope is that there will be messages coming out of that broader international effort about climate change and the impact on polar bears and Arctic communities. You know, in the United States, again, we really see this as one mechanism to spread the word about climate change. I mean, certainly there are other avenues to do that, but, you know, our efforts to tell a story about impacts to polar bears and to Arctic communities in Alaska, I think, will be an important voice to trying to see change going forward.
In the plan, it says that the populations in the Canadian Arctic are more likely to survive. Why is that? What's different there in Canada than in Alaska? Todd?
Well, I think you're referring to the analysis that we did that looked at, specifically in this case, the threats of loss of sea ice habitat to future population outcomes. And so what we did for that was group the subpopulations into four ecoregions. So these are kind of intermediate spatial scale units between the global population and the individual subpopulation. What we found was that there's a great likelihood that populations in the Canadian High Arctic, the Canadian archipelago, will be the last to feel the effects of reduced sea ice access or sea ice availability. The main reason for that is that's an area that's currently characterized by very heavy multi-year ice. Geographically, it's characterized by a number of narrow fjords and channels, which tends to act to retain that heavy multi-year ice. It's probably not the best sea ice habitat for polar bears right at this moment because it's so thick and it can sometimes prevent access to prey. As it warms, there's this kind of unusual paradox where it'll actually become better sea ice habitat for bears until it becomes too fractured and too unavailable where it'll begin to cause problems for persistence in that region. But our projections indicate that that's likely to be a long-term refugia for polar bears into the end of the century.
Todd, you and I have discussed before, there are other factors that can help. They're not nearly as large as sea ice loss, but there are other things that have been identified that are also contributing to the decline in polar bears or the future prospect of decline. What are those things and how much impact can they have?
Well, I think the key thing is to stabilize the loss of sea ice habitat. If we remain on the current greenhouse gas trajectory that we're on, that bodes pretty poorly for the futures of polar bears. We're likely to see extensive declines in distribution and abundance by the mid-century mark. If we're able to adhere to a trajectory that mimics reduced greenhouse gas emissions, keep the temperature from rising much above 2 degrees Celsius, The outcome for polar bears is considerably better. We're likely to see polar bears persist in a number of regions through the mid-century mark. If we then look at individual stressors, some of the things that we talked about earlier, like reducing the influence of defensive life kills, reducing the influence of exposure to contaminants, we're buying ourselves 3 to 5 to 7% declines in the probability of these populations transitioning into worsened outcome states. So we're kind of inching our way down below that dominant probability of transitioning to a worsened outcome state. So it goes back to my earlier point that those aren't unimportant. They also buy us time. The key here is that without mitigating greenhouse gas emissions, we're not making a meaningful impact towards long-term persistence by just managing those lesser threats.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer.
Just one quick follow-up on that. The plan does speak to the concern about climate change, but it goes on to identify some specific actions that we can be focused on in the near and midterm, which we believe will help with that smaller percentage, but at least the actions that we can undertake now to do what we can to keep polar bears around until the broader issue is addressed. So those are laid out in fairly broad terms. We tried to identify the highest priority actions. And you can see those in the plan. And I did want to just put in a pitch for the public to take a look. And please, we invite your review and your input on those actions if this is the opportunity to do that. So
we'll link to that report also on the website as we post the audio from this program. And Margaret, in our final minute, would you like to add something?
Well, and just as we're all here together to talk about polar bears, I was thinking about your question you asked Alaskan listeners, do polar bears matter? And really, this discussion is about polar bears, but it's really about people. Because just as the polar bears rely on the ice, we actually rely on the ice too. What is happening in the ice, the disappearance of the Arctic sea ice, is actually changing the way our jet stream is moving across North America. And that's changing weather patterns, and that's changing agricultural productivity, and that's changing economics of our people who are dealing with floods and strange storm systems. So really, that the polar bear is important because it's telling us what's happening in the environment, and we are all going to be feeling the impacts of the environment. So when Todd talks about whether or not we will be able to stabilize our greenhouse gas emissions, that's not just important for the polar bear, that's important for all of us.
The polar bear is the Arctic's equivalent of the canary in the coal mine, sort of. All right. Well, thank you so much to my guests today. This is a very important discussion. And as I mentioned, we will link to that report on alaskapublic.org with the audio so that Alaskans and others, people of the world, can go check that out and read that plan. It's very comprehensive. Thank you to Eric Regeer, to Jennifer Kohout, Margaret Williams, and Todd Atwood. And thank you, Alaskans, for tuning in and joining me. I'm Lori Townsend. Talk of Alaska. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.